Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I'm Ben Bullen. Oh, we're gesturing at each other across the table.
Who is going to start? Who's going to bring up the topic today?
The old question that we always ask. Would you like to do the honors?
Well, I tell you what. I'll bring it up this way. I think people have already probably read it in the title, but we're going to talk about Bluebird buses. We've got another topic that we talked about that was a Bluebird as well. I don't know if you remember or not. The Bluebird K7.
Oh, wow.
Do you remember that? I was just thinking about that.
The
Donald Campbell with his world speed record boat. Remember that?
Yes.
The Coniston Water story.
Yes.
So I think people should check that out. But we're going to talk about Bluebird school buses today, or Bluebird Corporation, or the Bluebird Body Company. I mean, it's gone by a few different names, right, over history.
Right, yeah. And we're going to walk through some of the history with this. Along the way, we're going to answer some questions about school buses that may have always mystified you, certainly mystified us for a while. Things like, why aren't there seatbelts in so many school buses? Things like, why are they yellow in the States?
Why were they even invented?
Why were they even invented?
Yeah. What was the purpose behind that? I mean, we've got answers to stuff like this along the way. And I think, man, you know, as we usually do, we go back to the very beginning with the founding of the company. And the guy's name is Albert Luce, spelled L-U-C-E. And barring any missing pronunciation marks or accent marks, rather, I think L-U-C-E is pronounced Luce, so we'll stick with that.
And if it is Luce or Lucy, we apologize.
Yeah, that's right. So this goes, but Mr. Albert Senior is not around anymore, so we're not apologizing to him. But his family members are still around,
right?
So we'll talk about them as well. But the story of Bluebird buses goes way back, way, way, way back, 1927,
which is nuts if you think about it.
Yeah, and really, I mean, Albert's involvement with automobiles and all things automotive goes back even farther than that, because this guy, he was an American industrialist. You know, of course, he later founded the Bluebird Corporation, but
right.
The idea is that he originally owned a Ford dealership in a town called Fort Valley, Georgia, which is and also in Perry, Georgia. He owned two dealerships. So
he was doing pretty well.
Yeah, he was doing all right for the time. I mean, in the late 1920s. And I guess the family was really heavy involved with all things automotive and cars, and, you know, just trying to, they had, I guess, some construction experience, you know, the guys in the shop that could do things with vehicles, some modifying, things like that.
Probably doing some custom coaching.
Exactly. And that came into effect, I guess, in 1927, or probably, you know, a little earlier than that, when he built his first bus. In 1927, it was a steel body construction, which was kind of unheard of at the time, right?
Yeah, and it was mounted on a Model T chassis.
Yeah, so a 1927 Ford Model T chassis, and it was at the request of one of his customers, and the guy's name was Frank Slade. And Frank Slade he lived in Marshallville, Georgia. And Frank wanted to use it obviously as a school bus, of course. But really there was nothing like this being produced at the time. There was something similar on the market, but they were wood-bodied vehicles.
Right.
And not the safest of vehicles, right?
Yeah, one of the earlier things would be the Navistar Model F, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, so there were other bus makers along the way, and I've got a short list of bus makers that would have been in competition with them that we'll get to in a moment, but, the guy, you know, Frank Slade, he just was curious about, you know, anything that he could do to improve the design that was already out there. So there's this wood bus structure that, you know, the kids have been going to school, to and from school in, and he just said, anything that could be better than what's already on the market, I want for my kids in Marshallville, Georgia, which is a nice thing, right?
Yes.
And he decides, you know, of course, he's going to use it for, you know, taking them back and forth from school. And the idea was that he was going to use what was a kind of a new technology at the time, believe it or not, steel body construction for this thing. And
right.
They used things like angle iron and, of course, roof bows and things like that. And it was all metal except for, this is kind of strange, it had a canvas top. Well, it had a canvas stretch top, and I don't know if that was just a time-saving thing, or if it was a time-restriction thing, or if it was like a safety exit, or I don't know what
they
the idea
out
was.
Of steel.
I don't know. I can't figure it out. I've looked at this bus, because you can look at the very first bus that was built. And what's the name of that?
The name of the first bus is the Bluebird Number 1.
Yeah, Bluebird Number 1. If you search that, you'll find exactly the vehicle we're talking about. And you'll know it by, you know, the front end of a Model T sticking out of the front end of what looks like a, you know, very boxy old style bus.
Yeah.
And a yellow school bus. Now the original idea behind this, you know, being that it was Frank's idea and then kind of brought into fruition or brought into real life by Albert Luce. He showed it around town and, you know, before he delivered the vehicle, and people were pretty favorable of the design. They thought, this is a good idea. I like the steel body construction. You know, I kind of like the direction you're going with this. Let's maybe think about putting this into production.
Yeah. And they started to say, let's see how we can tweak this for mass production. Mm-hmm. Right. And, I don't know exactly how we want to go into the timeline here.
Can I just mention one thing?
Yeah.
I know we're going to jump into the timeline. Okay. Like you said, that's fine. But before we get too far down the road and this won't make any sense, I want to say why school buses were even invented. Because, you know, kids were walking to schools. There was a...
Right. That's a good point.
It was a time of, the one room schoolhouse, and every little town had one. And, you know, it was on the other side of town, or it was right next to you if you were lucky.
It was within a few miles.
It was always uphill both ways. Remember that kind of thing.
It was always snowing.
It was always snowing. But, you know, it was either close or very far away, whoever you want to look at it, right?
Yeah.
So the kids were walking to school, or maybe they were hitching a ride on their dad's wagon, you know, the horse-drawn wagon, or maybe their family had a car and they were driving them to and from school. Mm-hmm. But then they started this idea that they were going to consolidate schools between different communities. So let's say that each little town, each little village didn't have its own school anymore, in its own little one-room schoolhouse. They said they were going to go to a larger school that was, you know, in the next town over. And then kids couldn't just simply walk back and forth from school every day. It was just too far.
Walking 18 miles is most of the day, maybe, for some of these kids.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, there's just a distance which you can't reach it. You know, you can't go that far, especially if you're just a young kid walking to and from school.
Yeah.
It's dangerous, whatever.
So the consolidation of
schools. They consolidated, and the need then was that they had to get, you know, large groups of kids to school instead of each family having to find their own way to get their kid to school. And some didn't have that. You know, they didn't even have a wagon, or they didn't have a car or whatever. The mobility wasn't the same. So, you know, they had these early school buses, which were really, I guess a bigger wagon, if you want to look at it that way.
Yeah, because the school bus idea sort of predates the evolution of the automobile, right?
Yeah, it does. And then you know, eventually it transferred to, you know, it's going to be automated, and we're going to run it on a car chassis.
Yeah.
And we're going to have this real basic looking thing with a lot of bench seats. You know, the idea was that it's almost like a train car on top of a car. You know, they can haul it back and forth. And, but it was still made out of wood. It wasn't the greatest design. And that's where Albert Luce stepped in and said, you know, we're going to do this with steel body construction because that's the way automobiles are going.
Right. And he knew his stuff about automobiles. You have to wonder, as an entrepreneur, it's very easy, I think, to see or imagine his mindset where he says, okay, I'm making money selling vehicles, but is the real money in making vehicles?
Yeah. So he did kind of put all his eggs in that basket and said, yeah, I think there really would be a lot more money in making vehicles. And he built a plant, and we're going to step into the timeline now. He built a plant in 1935, a factory that was just completely dedicated to school bus production. And this is in Fort Valley, Georgia, which was, of course, one of the towns where his Ford dealership was located.
Yeah.
And he called this company the Bluebird Body Company.
Oh, and this is funny.
What's that?
You were telling me off air. Why did he call it the Bluebird?
We called we've kind of struggled with the pronunciation of the name, right?
Right. Luce.
Yeah. We didn't know exactly what to call him. And he said, you know, instead of putting my family name on this, we're going to call it Bluebird, because he showed, I guess, a mock-up of this vehicle, a test vehicle to some students, when it was about, I think it was like 1932. Somewhere around there. And I think it was a blue and yellow model. And they called it the Bluebird. And of course, the kids loved it. They thought it was great.
Yeah.
They called it the Bluebird. And that name kind of stuck. And he said, well, that's a lot easier than having my name mispronounced on this product all the time. Let's just go with Bluebird. And that'll be real simple. No one's going to have trouble with that.
Yes. And it appears that he was completely correct. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry to interrupt. I just thought that was an interesting sidebar.
No, it is. It's an interesting note. And, you know, that original car, that original bus is still around. We'll tell you later where that, you can go see the original Bluebird Number 1.
Yep. You don't even have to be on the way to school.
Exactly. Exactly. So we're up to, 1935, he built this first plant that's dedicated to school bus production.
Right. We should mention also, I'm sorry to keep interrupting here, but we should mention that by 1940s era, the school bus idea has taken off.
Exactly. Yeah. Every town had to have one. It was the latest thing. They all wanted the steel body construction vehicle that Albert was producing, these Bluebird buses.
The safety record was just far beyond that of the wooden vehicles.
Exactly. Yeah. So, by 1937, they started building what we'll call an all steel construction. Now, I remember I mentioned with the canvas top and, there were still some wood elements left over in that original Model T vehicle.
Right.
And I don't know, how deep that goes. I don't know if it was, floorboards or what it was, but it wasn't a completely all steel construction until 1937 when it did flip over to all steel. And that becomes like kind of the benchmark for all other all other school bus manufacturers, really.
Right.
They all saw all steel as the way to go. So they did that. And there were competition. There were other builders at the time. I don't know. You want to mention them now? Okay. So
sure.
As far as I can count here, it looks like there were about five other school bus manufacturers in competition with Albert at the time he was building his factory in 1935, 1937, that era. So we'll start with the oldest. Get this, Ben. There was a company called the Wayne Corporation.
Uh-huh.
They were building school buses in 1837. Now, I don't know if they were actually building, I'm going to take that back. I don't know if they were actually building buses or if the corporation was in effect. It doesn't have a lot of detail here on this
list. I see what you're saying.
Now, they could have been building other vehicles, wagons of some kind, but 1837 indicates to me that they were probably building some type of transit vehicle that was taking kids to and from somewhere. I don't know if it resembled a modern bus or what.
Yeah.
But this is, and remember, these are all other wood designs, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
These are not the all steel construction. So in direct competition with Albert. I guess we'll go up to number two, which was the Gillig Corporation from 1890. Then it goes up to the Crown or Coach Corporation from 1904. And a lot of these companies, Ben, they stayed around until like the mid 1990s. So
yeah.
They had long, long histories. Then there was the Carpenter Industries, which makes sense, I guess, if it's a wood construction.
Yeah.
1919. And then the Ward Body Works, which is around from about 1933. And I guess there's another one that, I'm going to save that one. But, so you can see that he wasn't the only one doing this. He wasn't building the first bus ever or anything like that.
Right.
It was just he was taking a good idea and making it better, which is a lot of people do that.
To me, it kind of reminds me of Apple, the Apple Corporation. For a company that's hailed as innovative in a lot of ways, a lot of the fame that they found was doing things in a way that customers thought was just better.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe not inventing something so much as refining or reinventing it.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, he's taking, the idea that, these heavy duty trucks are perfect for hauling heavy weights around. And of course, people are heavy weights. And if you get a lot of them on the bus, even if it's a lot of small kids, the weight's going to add up and there's a definite market for these heavy duty vehicles and buses. By all means, are heavy-duty vehicles. You can see them on the road today. You can tell they're heavy-duty vehicles.
They're huge.
They're
big.
They're behemoths on the road. So with good reason, too. There's a lot of safety issues that are built into those things, and that's why they're so big.
And we'll get to that. I have some great statistics and some cool information about modern buses.
Okay, good.
Walk through the timeline.
I promise you we're going to get up to that, because let's zip through the timeline then, and we'll get to that to the modern day. How about that?
Yeah, let's take our time.
Okay, we'll do that, too.
Leisurely stroll through school bus history with
right.
Scott and Ben.
So I'll read some things, and if you have a comment, just bring it up. How about this?
All right.
I'm going to stop again. Fort Valley, Georgia. That's south of Atlanta. It's actually south and west of Macon, Georgia, which is about in the middle of Georgia. So just to give people an idea where this is all happening. And it's still there, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
So we're up to 1945. 1945, Ben, the original factory, the manufacturing plant and everything in Fort Valley, burned to the ground, completely destroyed by fire. So that's a bad stroke of luck for the Luce family. 1937, it was built. So 1935 it was built. So
yeah.
Just 10 years into operation, the whole thing burns to the ground. The whole operation, they've got to start over.
Right.
And it may turn out that was actually a good thing because it allowed them to build a slightly more modern facility. They've already got their plans in place for a new design because when Albert, I guess, after World War II, he had gone over to France. and he saw this idea for what he had called a like a vertical or a flat front end bus. And, you know, that's the school bus that we think of a lot of times now. There's a lot of modern buses with a completely, almost like a wall in front, very flat front end, right?
Yep.
Well, prior to that point, he had been using what was called a cowl-type chassis from, you know, typical heavy-duty truck of the day. Mm-hmm. So he was borrowing from a design that was already out there, and now he's kind of branching out into making his own chassis design, which is a big move for the company.
Yeah.
And with the new factory in 1945, this is perfect timing because, you know, allows him to set up the manufacturing exactly the way he wants. Now, by 1946, the present headquarters, which was, you know, in Fort Valley, Georgia, it was fully open for operations. In 1946, you know, they've got the factory up and online. So it's only a year after that completely burned down, which is amazing.
Yeah, that is.
We have to step over into 1950. We jump ahead about 4 years.
Okay.
And Albert Luce Jr. Takes over the head of the company as CEO, over as the head of Bluebird at that point. So he's in control in 1950. And the older Albert, I guess he steps aside, but he's still a player in the game. I mean, I think he's still, you know, making decisions from the sidelines.
I see.
We hear that a lot, right?
That happens often, mm-hmm. not just in car companies, but also in many family-owned companies.
Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just Albert Jr. That stepped in as well. There were a couple of other Luce brothers, George and Joseph, I think, were the other brothers that joined the company. And they hang around for a long time. We'll find out when they kind of dissolve their relationship, I guess, with the company. But man, we're in the mid-1950s, so 1952, Bluebird finally developed what they call the first dedicated forward-engine transit chassis. And that's kind of the idea that we're talking about here with, you know, this flat front end. And there's all these different chassis applications that Bluebird really, well, one they developed. Others they were kind of borrowing ideas from and, you know, using what they had seen out there that worked in other heavy-duty trucks and applications and modifying bodies to fit. And, you know, kind of a best practices, I guess.
They pioneered a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a little sidebar to weave into your timeline.
Sure.
Is that okay?
Yeah, of course.
I just thought that this might be the best way to address it. Scott, one of the questions we had at the top is why is a school bus, at least in the United States, yellow? And a very particular color of yellow too, right?
Yeah.
Very particular shade. Well, the answer to that doesn't lie in the Luce family. The answer to that is found in a guy named Frank W. Sear, another tricky name, C-Y-R.
I'll go with Sear.
That's the best shot I could take. He was a professor at Teachers College and Columbia University. He is known today as the father of the yellow school bus because in the 1930s, Scott, he traveled the country looking at pupil transportation, right? When this competition between school bus manufacturers was in a dead heat. So there's not really, at this point where he's traveling around, there's not really a standard school bus. There's just like a different manufacturers have different types, different engines, probably different safety standards as well. And he said that the standards in most of the cases have been set up in what he called hit and miss methods. So in 1939, Frank Sear brings together a bunch of educators, some manufacturers, the Luce representatives are definitely in there, and paint experts, and has a conference to have this nation's first school bus safety standards. 42 pages long, Scott, that was their agreement. This covers everything. What's the size of the interior compartment? What do we need to know about axles? What do we need to know about wheels, emergency brakes, et cetera? And then included in this was the color.
You know what? That's very interesting. That's all new to me. I had no idea because I was looking at pictures of Bluebird number one.
Yeah.
And it is indeed painted yellow and school bus yellow.
Yeah.
And that must have been after the fact because I remember that we mentioned that the Bluebird number one demonstrator that was brought to the kids was, I think it was a blue model.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they called it Bluebird to begin with. But eventually, of course, you know, probably along the lines of when you said, was it 1939?
Nine, yeah.
1939. I bet that's when, you know, they decided, well, we're going to have to start painting all these things yellow, even though we're called Bluebird, which may have been a little bit
odd.
It's
weird. I remember growing up and riding. Did you ride school buses when you were a kid?
I did, yes.
I think a lot of kids in the U.S. did. I remember looking at the Bluebird logo for years and wondering why you would call it Bluebird if it's painted yellow.
Yeah, it seems, I mean, just seems, of course, I mean, I'm going to say what everybody's thinking. Why isn't that Yellowbird? Why isn't it called Yellowbird?
Yeah, and as a kid, I wondered, I remember thinking, well, is it like a Sesame Street thing? Like, is that too close to Big Bird?
Oh, I don't know. Something like that.
But, so here's why they wanted yellow.
Okay.
Yellow could stand out. Other drivers can see a yellow school bus from a distance. And then it would be identified as a school bus by all the other drivers. So they would think, hey, there's a group of kids going someplace. Maybe I shouldn't tailgate them.
Understood. That's a great visual indicator, because imagine if it was that school buses were all different colors and you saw a great big red school bus headed your way, you might quickly mistaken that for a fire engine.
Yes.
You know, something like that. I mean, things like that could happen. You know, maybe one's stopping on the side of the road and you think you're okay to pass, but you know the rules of school buses. You have to stop if it's on the same side of the road and, you know, et cetera.
Exactly. Without, no passing.
Yeah. You know all the rules about passing when they're loading and unloading. If you thought it was a fire truck, you may just pass that vehicle and not really even think about it, not realizing that it was a school bus. Mm-hmm. So it's a quick visual sign to people to say, this is a school bus and, you know, watch out for this vehicle.
And right? People seem to get it, especially because so many people, again, at least in this country, we are qualifying everything because this is kind of U.S. specific mm-hmm. in a lot of ways. At least in this country, most people, if you didn't ride a school bus, you knew someone who did, you were familiar with it. At this conference, Scott, he has, Sear has like 50 shades of different types of yellow. Hmm. And they appointed a committee of educators to make the final choice. And there is a specific formula to this shade of yellow. According to Bob Riley, who's the executive director of the National Association of State Directors of Pupil Transportation Services.
That's quite a title.
That's a mouthful. He said that you can't buy a bus that doesn't meet that formula.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So there's this whole regime of rules built up.
Adhering to this 1939 rule or this 1939 set of rules that was put forth by this guy. Sear.
Yes. And so, we return to the 50s.
Oh, yeah. So we're back in the 50s and, you know, they're developing this engine transit chassis that they're developing for school buses. The forward engine design, durable, precise, optimized. Those are words you might hear that are associated with it. The all American forward engine type D school bus is what you may hear it called as, you know, that's like its formal title, I suppose.
Right.
And that's really that's the big one. That's the big daddy bus. You know, that's, the 72 passengers, flat front end, you know, that type of thing. They have a short wheelbase for maneuverability. They've got this great design. It's a really good idea. And there's a lot of pros to the design that came out in 1952. And, some of those have carried over all the way through, you know, through present day.
Right.
Okay. So 1962, we go ahead 10 more years and the founder of the company, Albert Luce, dies. He passes away in 1962. But of course his, sons are, you know, at the helm of the company and it's still cranking along. So in 1963, which is just 1 year after their father passed away, and I know that, you know, Albert Sr. was involved in this some way.
Right.
They start developing something called the Wander Lodge. And the Wander Lodge, which was brought out as a prototype in 1963, is a Bluebird vehicle, a Bluebird bus that is converted into a recreational vehicle. And what a fantastic idea for the company to kind of branch out from the school bus production, which they have been doing since 1927, if you want to get technical about it, but 1935,
yeah.
I guess. It's a Class A recreation vehicle, which is the big one, you know, that's a huge
right.
vehicle. They made them from, get this, Ben, from 1963 all the way through 2009. They're anywhere from 31 to 43 feet long, depending on what model you got.
Jeez.
And, these Wander Lodge vehicles, some of these were owned by, like, celebrities, I mean, famous people like Jimmy Carter, former U.S. president, Johnny Cash had one, King Hussein of Jordan ordered a Wander Lodge.
Huh.
They were a big deal at the time because, you know, here's a coach maker, a factory that's building a vehicle that is really, I mean, it's perfect for this. I mean, it's a great match because
yeah.
all they have to do is divert the line at one stage and say, all right, this one is going to be an RV. This one is going to be a school bus. And then they make the modifications to make each one happen, you know, whatever it has to be. And to make a Class A recreation vehicle, that's pretty cool. I mean, I've got some more notes I know about the Wander Lodge somewhere around here. I'll find them, but
they're pretty much apartments on wheels.
They really are. Yeah. They're really, really cool. And you can still find these things, you know, I guess, all over the place. I mean, you can still find one because they were made until 2009. And you may think like, well, I've seen, you know, these buses that have been converted into RVs and they don't look all that great. You know,
yeah.
some are clearly, and the early ones, I'll tell you, they look like a school bus that was made into an RV. The more modern Wanderlodge vehicles, the ones from the 2000s or even, you know, prior to that, some of them are just fantastic. I mean, they're everything you would expect out of those giant RVs that you pass on the road. They're really, really amazing.
See, I love this sort of stuff. Two of my friends who work for a local Atlanta nonprofit purchased a beat up old school bus that they then painted like green or brown or something so it wouldn't be school bus yellow.
Mm-hmm.
They named it Rosie. They put in some chairs. They had pretty much gotten it when it was already emptied out. And they made it like this open air apartment thing, and then they took it on tour for their band.
That is really cool. And you know what? That's going to play right into something that near the end of this podcast I want to talk about. I know you've got you today, Ben. You have a like a one last thing that you want to come up with. It's really interesting. And we talked about this, but there's some uses for old school buses, like decommissioned buses.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got a list of maybe five or six different things. But you've got like the crowning jewel of uses for decommissioned school buses, I think. So
well, now don't kill me with hype.
Well, okay, I don't want to overhype it, but it's pretty amazing. It's really cool, and I think our listeners are going to really appreciate it. So you know, 1964, we're back to where that's the first. And I'm going to go through the rest of these really quick, okay? And then we've got other things to talk about. But 1964, that's the first Wanderlodge that's really produced for public consumption. People can buy it. And I mentioned that, you know, these celebrities and big names bought them because it was a really nice vehicle at the time.
Yeah, and don't hurry through this list because I got to tell you, in terms of just weirdly fascinating stuff that was unexpected that we would run into, right? This podcast is one of the top ones. I've found so much fascinating stuff.
Yeah, it's such a topic that you would think that there would just be one angle on this. Like,
right.
Okay, it's a vehicle that takes kids to and from school. It's yellow. It's pretty big.
The end.
That's about it.
Yeah.
Diesel engine. How about that? Done. But it's so much more. There's all these little angles, and you know the family's pretty interesting. The start of it's really cool. You know, there's the whole chassis thing, which I don't even know if we're going to get to. But there's like four different types of chassis.
Yeah.
Let's get back on the timeline, and
okay.
I'll go through kind of quick. 1975. The first Microbird is introduced, and the Microbird is the shorter bus, which is still as wide. The deal behind this one is that it's still as wide as a full size school bus, and it's the one that has like the wheelchair lift on the side. It's for mobility concerns, right? So it's pretty big move because no one else was building anything like the Microbird at the time. They call it the Microbird. That's another side company that they have that builds. Vehicles. I think it's in Canada. I think Quebec, Canada is where this thing is built.
Okay.
And then in 1977, which seems counterintuitive after the Microbird, they built something called the Minibird, which we think would come before the Microbird, but, the Minibird is the shorter school bus, I guess. And, it's not quite as short as the Microbird, but it's right around that ballpark. You know, so if they got a smaller group of kids to take to school.
Yep.
That's the bus that they ride. You know, they save the one that has 75 seats or whatever, 72 seats.
Sure.
For the bigger halls, right? 1988, we're going to jump way ahead here.
Okay.
This is the first Bluebird rear engine design, and chassis built. So this is, again, the flat front end, that Ooh. Type of giant vehicle. And we've all seen buses with engines in the back end.
Right.
This is something new for Bluebird at the time. And with every one of these developments, Ben, it's them doing the development work on the chassis, the engine. They're, you know, a lot of times things are borrowed and you know, ideas are kind of played around with until they find something that's exactly right for their product. And this is one of the cases. This rear engine design was a big deal for them at the time. Then they start coming out with different models, which I don't know if we need to cover them, but the TC2000, which is, again, forward engine, that's introduced in 88. 92, the TC2000 rear engine is introduced, and then, you know, they start taking away these. They're retiring those models.
Right.
And it's sometime in the 1990s when the Luce family, I remember the remaining three brothers, they kind of give over the reins of the company to outside investors. And so from 1990, I don't know the year it was, but it was sometime in the 1990s. They gave over all of the interest in the school bus construction, the RV construction, which was still going on at the time, to these outside investors, and they're no longer involved with the company. So, you know, it was a family company until, you know, the mid-1990s. But not the case anymore. Now it's some outside company that owns Bluebird. All right, let's step up to the 2000s here. And, you know, they're redesigning and they're retiring vehicles all the time. Well, in 2007, they had their 80th anniversary. Then we moved up to 2012 where they had their 85th anniversary. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all along the way, they're redesigning. They're coming up with things like propane-powered vehicles. There's so many innovations along the way, Ben. The timeline's full. I don't know if we really want to cover all the detail that goes into it.
Yeah, because they have continually made innovations. That's a really good point, Scott. And I love that you mentioned the alternative fuel things they've been trying, engine redesigns. Safety, of course, is always a primary concern.
Yeah, and you want to talk about some safety things?
Yes, I want to talk about some safety things. First, though, I want to talk about a total lack of safety. What about that?
Sure, let's do that.
All right, so I have an Audible pick for you, my friend.
Oh, you do? So you've been on the audible.com website, right?
Yes, sir, I have, because traffic is a fact of life. It happens whether you're on a road trip or you're just driving down to your local grocery store for some food shopping. You can get stuck in traffic, and nothing alleviates traffic like a good story to listen to. And, you know, it's sad to say that sometimes, Scott, you and I aren't making podcasts fast enough. So I decided that I would recommend something you can listen to if you've already listened to all of our podcasts in traffic.
So you found a good one.
I found a great one.
What did you find? Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay. Noel, beat me out if I can't say this on the air. Go Like Hell, Ford, Ferrari, and their battle for speed and glory at Le Mans.
You were really worried about that title?
Well, I don't know, man. We're a family show.
No, I guess so. Okay, but sounds reasonable. What's it about?
Okay, so check this out. By the early 1960s, Ford Motor Company, built to bring automobile transportation to the masses, was falling behind. Baby boomers were taking to the roads in droves, looking for speed, not safety, style, not comfort, and Ford didn't offer what the young drivers wanted. Meanwhile, Enzo Ferrari lorded over the European racing scene, crafting beautiful, fast sports cars that epitomized style. Written by A.J. Baim, narrated by a guy named Jones Allen, this is 8 hours and 49 minutes. It's an unabridged story about the culminating battle between Ford and Ferrari at Le Mans.
Oh, Ben, this is one of my favorite topics. This is the development of the Ford GT40. You're going to hear the Ford GT40 story in what, 8 hours and some odd minutes.
Yep.
That is going to be such a cool book.
And I thought of you when I checked this out, because I thought, man, Scott would love this one.
I really would. That's going to be a good one.
With that, here we are. We're going into modern school buses. Scott, I've got some stats to lay on you. Are you ready?
Let's have it.
All right. There's about 4,800,000 yellow school buses providing transportation across the United States.
That's quite a few.
That is quite a few. The people on these buses, there's about 26 million elementary and secondary school children riding the bus twice a day.
Wow.
That's more than 52 million trips daily. That equals more than 10 billion individual student rides, 20 billion boardings and deboardings annually.
These numbers are blowing me away, Ben. That's
when you count field trips also.
I understand. Okay. Yeah, I understand. Oh, I love field trips, by the way. That was always the best day in school.
That is the best day.
All right.
Day.
So, man, I mean, what you're saying is that these are extremely important to making everything work every single day.
Right. 53% of all K-12 kids, kindergarten to seniors in the United States, ride these yellow school buses.
You know what? I know we keep saying that in the United States this and in the United States that, but I say a lot of this stuff translates over to worldwide. I think that, you know, they're very important worldwide. They have a lot of the same safety standards, I know. You know, the way that they're built, the way that they're, you know, even the colors that they are, the mm-hmm. manufacturers, they ship them all over the world. It's not like they're just limited to the United States. So what we're talking about is not just limited to you and I and where we are here in the United States.
True.
But I do think that, you know, it's a good point out that, you know, all of our information is coming from the United States, that, you know, if there is some variance in there, it's because, you know, the information that we're receiving here is for the United States.
But it is probably, or at least hopefully, equitable, because a lot of this information is really good. Before we went to our audiobook break, we were talking about safety. Check this out. I thought you'd like this stat, Scott. According to the National Safety Council, school bus accident rate is 0.01 per 100 million miles traveled.
That is really incredible. That's extremely low. I mean, that's a great number. You know, occasionally you'll hear, you know, that somebody has bumped into a school bus on the way to school or something. You know, there's an accident involving a school bus. You know, you always hear that on on the radio. Not always, but occasionally. But it turns out that, you know, with as many buses there are, as many trips as they make, the number of times that they're involved in an accident is very, very low.
Yes, absolutely. The feds actually consider school bus transportation to be about 9 times safer than other transit.
Oh, that's amazing. I'd never heard that, but that's a good stat. And you know what? It makes parents feel much better when they hear something like that. So
it does, huh?
You know, the safety features we talked about, it's a lot of stuff that I think a lot of people will kind of look over and not really understand why it's a safety feature, and maybe not even understand how it works. But, you know, we talked about, you know, the safety record, I guess, you know, that they don't often get in collisions. The drivers are well-trained, et cetera. You know, they know what they're doing.
Oh, man. They
go through courses, and they do learn how to drive. It's not something like you just step in and say, I want to be a bus driver and do it the next day.
It's not for me, but I admire those people so much.
They've got to have so much patience.
Oh, gosh. 40 kids, man.
Patience of a saint is what you have to have.
Yes.
Yeah. So, all right. So a lot of things that, you know, you won't think about, but are really related to school bus safety are things like, you know, the purpose-built chassis, you know, that people don't really consider that, but they're built for durability and optimization and, of course, safety in collision situations, things like that. There's also the panoramic windshield in the front.
Yes, which, exceptional visibility.
Yeah, really good sight lines, especially with the flat front vehicles. You know, the cowl vehicles, those have always been a concern for drivers because there's that zone out in front where they can't really see what's happening down below the front of the school bus. And that's a big liability area for drivers, and they've always had a concern about that. And the flat front buses that, you know, Albert Luce came up with, or, you know, at least he modeled his buses after, was a big move forward. I mean, it allowed the bus driver to see directly below in front, and it's a big safety jump. Also, there's and you wouldn't think about this, but there's like the front axle is really unique in that it allows a 50 degree maximum cut from the steering wheel. So this is really great for maneuverability.
Yes.
It allows the bus driver to maneuver in extremely tight situations because they're headed into neighborhoods and subdivisions that aren't really built for big vehicles. I mean, you've seen like a moving van come in and they have the toughest time getting to the back of the neighborhood and then back out again.
Right, especially in older neighborhoods with narrow roads.
Exactly. I mean, even bigger vehicles like, you know, like garbage trucks and things, they have trouble with smaller roads. But a school bus is really, I mean, you wouldn't think of it, but a school bus is actually sort of a nimble vehicle in that it has this really short wheelbase, which a lot of people have overlooked as well. But take a look the next time you see a bus, how long the bus is versus how short the wheelbase is. There's overhang on the front and the back.
Yep.
And with this really tight steering, these buses are able to turn in and out of traffic without really breaching the second lane. You know, they don't have to go into oncoming traffic to get into their turn lane.
Right.
Which is a big deal. Able to, you know, navigate around courtyards and neighborhoods and get around things without knocking over every mailbox. That's another big idea. Let's see, what else?
Oh, even if they do get hit in a collision, they've got the fuel tank in between frame rails.
Yeah, that's part of that custom chassis, right?
Yep.
I mean, and these tanks are big. Some of these tanks can be up to 100 gallons of fuel. So that's a big deal. If that was to be struck and ruptured or somehow breached, that would be a big deal. You know, you've got 100 gallons of fuel spilled out. So putting it between the fuel rail, between the chassis rails is a big deal, as well as also positioning it so that, you know, with the overhang in the back, it's going to take, you know, the bus is pretty much going to have to be broken in half in order for them to reach the tank from the back end of the vehicle. So it's a lot of things like that. There's also the, you know, the Cummins engines, which are really reliable diesel engines, and they're, you know, they've got a variety of horsepower ranges that you can choose from. Some are fuel efficient, some are, you know, a little more power for the bigger buses. All of them, of course, meet federal, you know, current federal emission standards and all that stuff, right? So they're emissions compliant. They've got things like tilt steering, telescoping steering for the driver, you know, for driver comfort. And you wouldn't think that's much, but it makes a big difference if the driver's comfortable driving the vehicle versus, you know, having to kind of sit with this big wheel in front of them like a table that they're steering, you know, that flat wheel.
That's a good description.
And, let's see. They use things like Huckspin fasteners, which I didn't really know about until I read about them, but they're like this bolt and collar latching system or fastening system that they use in the assembly process, and they're extremely heavy duty. They're for they're like durable fasteners for heavy duty vehicles.
Oh, okay.
Any application that requires that, like aftermarket repair, things like that. So, you know, look for these Huck spin fasteners, which are like this collar and bolt thing.
Yeah.
Also, there's
Emergency exits, just like on a plane.
Yep. Yep.
Which, oh, all right, when you were riding buses as a kid, did you always dream of taking the cool exit?
You know, I did, and we had drills. You know, we were able to do that, and that was kind of cool. You know, to be able to hop out and, you know, help the other kids out, and, you know, there was a procedure that you would do, and you didn't do the drills too often, but
no.
I always did kind of look at that, you know, emergency exit and wish that at my stop I could just jump out at the
I felt like we were going in a drop zone. I used to daily fight the temptation to just wait until we were going maybe up a hill or something, pop open the door, have the fire alarm or whatever it is go off, and then duck and roll out.
Very cool.
I would be a legend in middle school.
You definitely would be.
Be arrested in middle school.
You would also be in a lot of trouble from your
maybe
parents.
Maybe hit by a car.
So, you know, we mentioned some of these other safety things, right?
Right.
And I just quickly list some more, and then we'll move on to,
okay.
I think I want to move on then to some uses for old school buses. How about that?
Yes. One question we would be remiss if we did not answer, why don't school buses have safety belts? It sounds like the setup to a joke.
It does. And you know what? I've got a couple of guesses, and I don't know if you know the true answer or not,
yeah,
but my guesses are that for some reason these find themselves in a position where they're not really required to have them, sort of like a shuttle bus would back and forth from the airport. If you're taking it from the shuttle lot to the airport terminal, you know, you're not required to be buckled in those. They have seat belts, but you're not required to use them. School buses, some school buses I think have them, but you're not required to use them. Others don't even have them at all. Is it something to do with maybe the padding on the back of the seats or the height of the vehicle? I just don't know.
That's, you know, you hit the nail on the head on a couple of things, because there is a multi-part answer to it. All right. So first, very astute, Scott. Not a lot of people know that not all school buses go without seat belts. Most do, but in some states, they have to have seatbelts. And some of it goes back to the weight of the vehicle. For instance, if you have a school bus under 10,000 pounds, then you have to have some sort of 3-point restraint system available on all newly manufactured buses, but only 7 states require those to be used.
Oh, that's very few. I would think it'd be more than that.
Yeah, and on buses over 10,000 pounds, only 3 states require you to have a seatbelt.
Interesting.
So they don't all have to have seatbelts, but they do have, at least in the states, again, they do have some state-by-state differences. It goes back to the safety of the vehicle itself. Already, they're tremendously safe vehicles. And then there's the question of, if all these kids are strapped in and something happens and you have to evacuate, how do you manage that herd of cats?
Man, what a quandary, right? I mean, you've got kids that you want to keep safe, but you also think that, like, if there is some kind of bad situation going on, you've got kids that maybe don't know how to get out quickly or that are wrapped up in the seatbelts. I mean, it's a terrible thing to think about, but, you know, there's like pros and cons of each one, and which would you rather have? I mean, they make them safe, you know, and that the height of the vehicle is part of the safety of them, you know, that they're
right.
Extremely high up, so any side collision would not very likely. It's not very likely to intrude into the passenger area of the bus. You know, maybe the footwell area, but that's not up near the torso part.
Mm-hmm.
If they roll over, of course they're rated for rollover. They've got, you know, safety standards in place, bars and things like that.
Right.
Up. But you don't want people flying around the interior of that if it rolls over.
Right. And that this idea might change, because according to Cecil Adams, writing for Straight Dope, the question of seatbelts on buses is still a bit controversial. There are federal investigations over whether or not they should be required in all school buses, regardless of weight.
Also, you know, it's not like an airplane before takeoff, when a stewardess walks through and makes sure that,
right.
Excuse me, flight attendant walks through the aisle and makes sure that everybody has their seatbelt on. It's not that way. The bus driver doesn't have time to do something like that. So let's say you do put, you know, you have seatbelts in every seat and, you know, everybody's supposed to be wearing them. How are you going to know that, you know, 5 or 6 kids out of the 70 that you have on board are not wearing their seatbelts? And those are the ones that are going to be injured in the wreck.
Right. And how are you to know that they have their stuff applied correctly? Because as we know, a misapplied seatbelt can be more dangerous in some instances. There's also a cost benefit analysis. If we outfitted the more than 400,000 school buses, with, seatbelts at $1,800 a bus. Those are numbers Cecil Adams is using. It'll cost $800 million. The annual death toll in school buses is about 11.
Oh, boy.
About 11 are injured in fatalities.
This cost-benefit analysis.
It's cold.
Is,
it's ice cold.
It is. It's an extremely cold business to be in, but it's necessary, I guess, right? Man, that's tough. I don't even like to think about it at all. And the reality is that buses are involved in accidents. Very few times. I mean,
very few times.
Very, very few
and
times.
They're big. They're the whales of the sea that is the road system, right?
That's right. You know, and the whales of the sea with flashing red lights and amber lights and
yeah.
strobe lights. And,
yeah.
You know, they've got that safety bar zone in the front of the bus that I want to mention, you know, that,
yeah.
you know, it kind of helps a little bit. I guess you got to trust that, you know, kids are still adhering to the rules around that as well. You know, that big bar that sweeps out and keeps
the stop sign.
Exactly.
And they might mount cameras on those pretty soon to catch people from passing.
That's true. That's a great idea as well. And, you know, I mean, why not mount a camera on front to show the front of the bus, you know, so that, you know, you're sure there's not a kid under there? Because it seems like every year, Ben, as horrible as it sounds,
yep.
some kid drops a paper, drops a book or whatever, and ends up under the bus. And it happens every year somewhere in the United States, somewhere it happens.
It's a sad story.
It really is. And that's what, you know, all these little safety devices that they've added on throughout the years, these all help quite a bit. Now, there's like that, you know, the pop-out bar that I mentioned. There's also the yep. pop-out stop sign that I think everybody's seen on either on a school bus or on an ice cream truck.
Right.
Same idea, right? Emergency exits that we talked about, the vehicle height we talked about, also escape windows, you know, the windows that all, you know, all those open
man.
Windows open, but then there are certain windows I think that you can knock
out.
Yeah,
yep.
you can pop the full thing out as an escape, and that's good as well. Of course, there's the large overhang that we mentioned, the fuel tank. There's just,
yep.
there's so many safety elements built into these things, going all the way back to 1939 to that conference that you talked about, you know, where they initially set up these rules, these standards.
Yes.
That, you know, you can see how all this stuff has evolved and changed throughout the time. And they've taken some of the things that didn't work and gotten rid of those and added new. And they're constantly trying new safety devices.
Right. And this is a continual conversation because, as we know, if you're a manufacturer known for safety, you work continually to keep that reputation.
Mm-hmm.
But Blue Bird Corporation is going strong. In 2013, their 550,000th school bus rolled off the line.
Mm.
So, they are more than halfway to 1 million buses.
That's pretty impressive. And I remember I mentioned the five other, school bus manufacturers that would have been in competition with them in 1935.
Yes, sir.
Well, today, there's at least, I'm looking at a list of here of 1, 5, 6, 7, at least 9 or 10 of these things, that are still in competition with Bluebird. Things like IC Bus, which was, I think that's international. You've probably seen international on them. Thomas Built, there's Collins Industries, there's Starcraft, TransTech, VanCon, Lion Bus. There's a lot of different companies that are in competition with Bluebird even today. And there were a lot more along the way that kind of, you know, developed and then faded away.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the initial five that I mentioned are gone. I think all of the initial five I mentioned are gone. And there have been, I mean, looking through the list here, there's probably 20 others
mm-hmm.
that were in the school bus manufacturing business, but went away. And, you know, there's a lot of old school buses hanging around out there. There's so many of them that you mentioned, you know, your friends that had converted one into kind of a living space.
Yeah.
And then took a tour what was it, a band, right?
Yes. Yes,
yeah.
sir.
Very cool.
What do you have? Have you found some uses?
I've got a couple, and I know we're leading up to your big
I'm
one.
Chomping
here,
at the bit.
But, you know, one was, of course, you can use an old bus as an RV, and I found my note about the Wonder Lodge.
Yeah, go.
Other side note that I didn't cover already was that, you know, some of these do look like school buses that are converted. Others look like RVs. So, you know, you either think like, well, there's a converted school bus that's now an RV, or you think that's a cool RV.
Right.
That's like kind of your opinion.
Or you think, wow, that RV is the size of a bus.
Well, in 1964, exactly. They definitely did look like a school bus. And in 1964, when they were first launched, the cost was $12,000 for a brand new one, right?
64?
1964. If you want to extrapolate that to 2013 with the, you know, the calculator that I do occasionally.
Yeah.
That's still very expensive. So big RVs have always been a wealthy man's toy. These things today, $12,000 in 1964 is equal to $90,533.03.
Oh, there's no way. There's no way I could own one.
So it's as if, you know, they launched with this product that today that would be $90,500. So that's a little out of reach for a lot of people. And I know that some get into way into the six figure amounts, you know, $500,000. So maybe that's still a bargain. I don't know, in the world of RVs, but you could convert one over to like a church bus, you know, some other type of transportation or a community center that needs a bus. They can just use them as is. They often have to paint them. They can't really be left school bus yellow.
And also, there have been people who take junker school buses and bury them. Have you heard about this?
Oh, yeah, I have seen that.
The two ways I've heard it used are people who maybe are, let's say, somewhere between creative and paranoid, and they decide that they're going to bury a school bus or bury two and just live in this underground hobbit hole kind of thing. Or they're growing drugs.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I've seen them exactly the way you're talking about, buried up to the roof line.
Yep.
And then there's kind of a cement enclosure for the emergency exit area. And that's the door to get into this thing. And it becomes an underground bunker, right?
Yep.
And I've never heard of anybody connecting two of them together. I've only seen photos of one, but it's a neat idea, really. I mean, it's like it's a pre-made room, I guess, that you're just submerging underground. And of course, then it's all filled in next to it. You dig a hole and you drive this thing in and it never comes out.
Yeah.
Which is pretty interesting. I don't know what they do with the windows. I guess they have to seal those off somehow.
I'm worried about the engine too. I don't know.
It's probably out of there at that point, I would think. Anyway, so there's the underground bunker thing. That's a good idea. Also people use them as a home. In fact, if you go to Mental Floss, you know, the site Mental Floss.
Yeah.
There's an article there that's called 15 Creative Converted School Buses.
Oh, cool.
And there's all kinds of things you can look at there. So the idea of them as a home is something that's not new. You know, an RV is kind of like what you're talking about, but it becomes their primary residence. It's not just for, you know, the weekend trips, the week long trip that you take, you know, to the beach or whatever.
Why not just cut the top off at an angle and make it the world's longest pickup truck?
You know, it's been done. I'm sure that, you know, there's a pickup version out there somewhere. I've seen stuff like this happen.
Yeah.
Also food trucks. People
Great
like
idea.
To use them for food trucks because there's a lot of space. You could even, with a school bus, you could even have a food truck with indoor seating, which I've seen.
That's classy.
Which
actually.
Is pretty neat. Yeah, it's kind of cool. Party bus. That's a good one.
Oh, yeah. Those are popular in Atlanta.
I think so, yeah. I mean, for rental or personal use, I guess you can have a designated driver that'll
take
you to and
from. You're just one, dancer pole away, right? Take the seats out, put in a pole, it's a party bus.
I guess so, Ben. However you want to party, I suppose. But from parties or sporting events or whatever, you know, whatever the case, I'll leave that other thing to you. Also, storage space. I guess you could use them if you have a lot of property. You could just park them and use them as, you know, like a place to put things if you wanted to, which is kind of an expensive way to do it, I guess, instead of just building a small building. But hey, if somebody's got a bus laying around for $500, that beats buying a shed, right?
That is true.
All right. So also my last one really here before we unleash with your idea, figure eight school buses, of course. You could buy a bus, an old decommissioned school bus, and race it in a figure eight school bus race, which is fantastic fun.
Yeah, I think the best question, really, let's rephrase that question, Scott. I think the question is, why wouldn't you?
That's a good point. Because maybe you have other plans for it, like some people that you know, right?
Right. Okay, there we go. Now, I also think this is cool, but I hope the hype hasn't been destroyed. Listeners, if you know about the show, you guys know that I had lived for a time in Central America. In my travels, in my sketchy past, I used to live in Guatemala, and a lot of decommissioned Bluebird buses specifically make it down to Guatemala, Central America, Mexico, South America, and in Guatemala they become a thing that's called chicken buses.
Yeah.
Now just, you have to look it up, just Google chicken bus, type in Guatemala if you need the extra hand. These are fantastically decorated. They're like the Decatur trucks of that time.
Absolutely.
Right?
And when you said chicken bus, this is not what I had in mind at all. I thought instinctively of a chicken coop.
Right.
This somebody was using as a chicken coop, which is another use for a decommissioned school bus.
But people will transport livestock on these buses. The drivers are notoriously crazy. They're all characters, man. They're all very unique individuals. Where I was located is kind of in a mountainous area. And so there are a lot of roads that cut along the sides of mountains. And these guys are driving fast. And I don't want to say they're bad drivers, but they are assertive drivers rather than maybe defensive drivers.
Well, they have to be good drivers to navigate those roads, because the roads that you're talking about are the ones that we talked about on our Most Dangerous Roads episode.
Yep.
The exact same roads, you've traveled on them. You've been in a bus in them. That's a terrible, like a harrowing situation to be in, I think, when it's raining or, you know, it's slick in any way. Of course, they're slick all the time because of the gravel and stuff that's
right.
involved there.
Yeah, and landslides can be a problem.
Even another vehicle coming the other way could throw you for a loop, really, because these things are tight. I mean, the roads are extremely tight. The turns, I mean, the inside edge is against the wall of the mountain. The right side of the vehicle or the outside edge, it's just a sheer drop-off.
Yeah, you kind of just have to... Kind of just have to close your eyes and, you know, be at peace just in case.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm not trying to exaggerate it.
No, it's not exaggerated, because you told me that one time, you mentioned livestock as well.
Yeah.
You told me, and they're called chicken buses. You told me one time you ended up holding a chicken.
Yeah, it's true. One of the rides that I took was about 3 hours from where I was staying. And, you know, these buses are kind of a public transit, which is a little bit more efficient, actually, than transit in the U.S. And they will pull up, and they're predetermined stops and routes, so people will pay a very small fee to hop the bus. And they'll often be coming from rural communities, maybe carrying stuff they want to trade or sell. And so I sat next to this really nice family. Also, Scott, these buses get very crowded. So it's very crowded, in a very crowded situation, and this lady was busy with her baby, and her husband was holding some stuff. They were the nicest people, and they asked me, well, they kind of asked me, but they pretty much forced me to, like, hold this chicken for them. And it was at the time I was very proud of my really poor Spanish, and so I was trying to attempt to speak in Spanish. You know, I don't want you to, like, oh, thanks, I don't want to hold this bird, but I didn't really have a choice. They were very nice. And then they started talking about me in Quiche, which is like a Maya dialect. And I didn't know that at all.
But you're sure they're talking about you?
Yeah, man, you can tell.
You know what? You're holding their chicken. It had to have been favorable, right?
I would hope so.
Yeah, I would think so.
It was probably, look at this moron. But who knows? The thing is that if you get a chance to go down there, check out the bus depots, the photograph opportunities are amazing, but you're also just a Google search away. That is one of the little known, or maybe it's well known, but little known in the United States, destination for decommissioned school buses.
I had never heard of chicken buses until you brought them up, and now that I've seen them, I'm kind of fascinated with the artwork and everything that goes along with them, and even the people that operate them.
Yes.
I would like to know more about them. Of course, you know, on these sites, there's not a whole lot about that, but
right.
You do see some videos of these things in action. These guys drive fast. They drive a little bit fast. I'll say fast and loose. They're a little bit crazy.
Yeah.
And sometimes you see pictures of these things with people on top. You know, that are kind of, they're holding things
luggage,
down,
yeah.
You know, they're holding luggage down, any type of extra cargo that they can fit up there, just barely making it underneath wires and overpasses and things like that. It's got to be quite an adventure to drive or to ride on a chicken bus. And, I mean, that's really cool that you've got firsthand experience.
I think all the podcasters should get together. We should go on a chicken bus world tour, Scott.
Not a bad idea.
We'll need to do that. I think I owe Jonathan and Lauren an apology here on Tech Stuff. We got so excited about school buses that we might be running into their time, man.
I see. Is that who's knocking on the door?
Yeah. Well, it's either them or the school bus police.
No, yeah, it could be them.
Yeah, but thank you guys so much for checking out our episode on the school bus. Scott, you and I found some fascinating stuff. We'd love to hear your stories about school buses, listeners. You can find us on Facebook, drop us a line on Twitter, check out our website, carstuffshow.com, and send us an email. Our address is
carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.